On the next Mind's Eye Radio, it's The Great Escape, or There Must Be Some Way Out of Here. An audio montage of poetry and prose about escaping routine, escaping fear, escaping the mortal coil, or the daily toil. All that and more from the next Mind's Eye Radio. The Great Escape, or There Must Be Some Way Out of Here. That's Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach. What is this life, if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare? No time to stand beneath the boughs and stare as long as sheep or cows. No time to see when woods we pass, where squirrels hide their nuts in grass. No time to see in broad daylight streams full of stars like skies at night. No time to turn at beauty's glance and watch her feet, how they can dance. No time to wait till her mouth can enrich that smile her eyes began. A poor life this, if full of care, we have no time to stand and stare. Leisure by William Henry Davies. Today's Mind's Eye Radio show is The Great Escape, or There Must Be Some Way Out of Here. We're giving our co-producer a break, or escape as it were, from writing the introductions to the pieces, and instead, the writers wrote and will read their own. This also means that I'll be behind the curtain for much of the show, stepping out as needed. It looks like a great show of original poetry and prose, so sit back and enjoy The Great Escape, or There Must Be Some Way Out of Here. How many times have you dreamed winning the lottery, suddenly being relieved of all the burdens life heaps on us, being able to purchase whatever you need to, if not erase, at least soften the edges of that daily suffering? But whether it's winning the lottery, finding the perfect partner, landing the perfect job, there's a disturbing question that lingers around the edge of those desires. Where lies the true suffering? In our day-to-day struggles, or in the endless longing to escape from them? Geithner Waldson grapples with this thorny question in his poem, Escape Your Life.
The Buddhists say all life is suffering. Is that why Houdini fought so hard to escape? Devised ever more clever contraptions of containment, as if proving to his God he had earned the right to leave. And those other great escapers, the debonair World War II tunnelers who traded Red Cross chocolate to German guards for passports, sugar for money, milk for shovels to dig deeper than any grave digger, and finally to freedom, only to be rounded up and shot one by one by guards whose suffering the chocolate had not abated. A not so great escape. To leave is always on the minds of true prisoners, yet when released back into the world, they soon ache for the safety of a 6x8 cage. How odd we non-convicts think, until we remember how much we still pine for her, the ex who did the next-door neighbor every day at lunch, or long for him who grunted through our own lovemaking like digging ditches, or return to our families for the holidays, those who still inject emotional paralysis into our soul and deny ever having a needle. Escape, escape. Escape is something the travel agents claim to know worlds about. Flee your mundane life, their glossy posters cry. Abandon the computer, dump the kids, fly to Peru, scale the heights of Machu Picchu. witness where the temple masters buried children alive, hoping that by sacrificing purity they might escape the wrath of their gods. But here's the question. Was the true God hidden amongst the boulders, gently calming the children as they expired underground? And are the masters of Machu Picchu still offering up their future against a suffering they can never, ever escape? This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Esther Cameron has an idea for escape that she believes may be constructive.
There's a Hasidic saying to the effect that whoever works for the coming world lives in the coming world. Constructive action is valuable not only for the benefit that one hopes will result in the future, but also for the sense that it gives us in the present of escape from a world of limited possibilities. The poem I'm going to read is about an escape I believe could be constructive. It actually starts out as an escape to the past, as a fairly faithful translation of a poem by Walter von der Vogelweide, who wrote in the early 13th century. Walter was depressed about the way the world had changed since his youth. Sound familiar? Among other things, Walter felt that people weren't dressing as well as they used to. In the early 90s, when I wrote my version, students in the U.S. were not yet dressing like the workers in China, so I didn't include the line about clothes, as I began replacing Walter's observations with some comments on what I was seeing. But I did include some of Walter's melancholy reflections on the nature of human existence as a whole. Walter's third stanza is devoted to the escape route that he chose, which was to urge participation in the current crusade. Well, that escape route didn't quite work for me, so instead of translating Walter's third stanza, I put in a signpost pointing to my own mental refuge, to wit, the hexagon, an imaginary center for poets as the recorders of the community's inner life. The hexagon is described at greater length in a poem by that name on my website, www.pointandcircumference.com. The website also has some suggestions in prose for how the fantasy could be realized if poets would work for it. And meanwhile, as that Hasidic saying has it, they would, in a sense, be living in it. It seems to me that this would be a great escape from just staring at the marginalization of writers in a deteriorating social environment. The last line of the poem, again, is Walter's. Lament and good counsel. Alas, where have my years gone? They fled so fast away. I know not if my life was real or shadow play. I wake and look about me, and do not understand what used to be as plain to me as my own hand. The land where I was born and bred appears more strange than a traveler's tall tale, a scene of monstrous change. The children that I played with are weary and old. The field is built upon, the forest has been sold. Lucky for me, the water still flows downhill, or I would truly think that my affairs go ill. Slow greetings have I had from many a former friend. The world is full of ungrace, wheresoever I wend. When I remember good days with friends at my side that have vanished like a stone skimmed on the water wide, woe's me forevermore. Alas, how careworn go the young, not hope but dread fills their minds with thought of future yearly bread. Even at play they practice violence and scheme. They have lost love's high heart and freedom's higher dream. They have no use for poets. They cannot share the joys of true and fitting speech, but stop their ears with noise. They do not seek the sunlight nor good society. On a computer screen they seek reality. When I think where things tend, the whole creation often appears to me only a slow damnation. Aye, earth is fair to look upon, green, white, and red, but inwardly a darkness full of charnel dead. Within the gold of honey I see the drop of gall. Things sweetest to the taste have turned to poisons all. Woe's me forevermore. Alas, I speak but idly, letting the craft of fools intimidate me into laying down my tools. There still is much within this world that I can praise. Imagination was given me that I might think up ways to show and to commend it, inspiring folks to care and learn to keep the world they've got in good repair. While I've a word to speak, I may as well make it count, and if there are others like me, our words may yet amount to counsel and to wisdom and justice in the end. And lately I have heard from a trustworthy friend that poets are combining to build the House of Song, a place for poetry they call the Hexagon, where poets can foregather and keep the things they write and make the center manifest in fools and time's despite. Once I have found a way there, a way that I can go, then will I ever sing for joy and nevermore cry woe. Hoping to see you there, I'm Esther Cameron from Mind's Eye Radio.
Emergency exit. I'm supposed to be writing on this unseasonably warm November morning, finishing a poem, forcing it into sonnet form. Instead, I sit at my desk, staring out the window, watching the children in the schoolyard below, the roly-poly boy in the white shirt who looks like a ball of cotton on two sticks, and the skinnier one who trails him, fake fighting, Jackie Lee karate kicks, punches into the air, jabs that never meet their target. Three more join in. The roly-poly boy seems to like this attention. He jabs back, smiles, then walks away, heading toward the loner, the only boy who hasn't peeled off his bright blue jacket to play, the one who is separate, the one who looks like he should belong, but who never strays from the edges of the fence, wearing a path back and forth, back and forth in the fading frozen grass, his eyes focused on an emergency exit sign above the schoolyard gate, as if planning his escape or preparing himself for the impending disruption to his secret, private world. Even in third grade, he knows being alone is something you get used to. And when the other boys crowd him, he moves away without resistance, without a fight. And when the bell rings, he slowly, reluctantly, turns and follows the others, his eyes trailing back toward the sign and the world beyond the gate. This is Bridget Birdsall from Mind's Eye Radio.
Josephine Zell grew up in the Lancashire town of Briarfield in England during World War II. She writes here about her childhood.
The nice man on the sidewalk who quietly said to me, "There was nearly no Josie," must have seen the delivery van come to a sudden stop as I ran across our cobbled street. I felt silly again with this man smiling so kindly at my mistake. It was right outside our back garden door, opposite the high wall that ran the length of the row of houses, so I was not visible to my mother. As far as I know, she was never told how, that day, when I was 6 years old, there was nearly no Josie. In 1940, a year after the outbreak of World War II, we had moved back from Scotland to the north of England in order to be nearer to my mother's sister and her family. By 1941, the war was at its height, and my parents and aunt and uncle decided to take advantage of the opportunity to send children to Canada on one of the children's boats for the duration of the war. I was 7, and my cousin, Julian, was 11. We were to live with his uncle Jim in Toronto, whom I had never seen, but who always sent his relatives wonderful Christmas packages of food unobtainable in Britain, which was shared with us. I remember the excitement. I had a grey cloth-covered trunk in which were packed clothes, shoes, and a splendid leather shoe-cleaning kit. How thrilling to me were the new brushes, the tin of brown polish, yellow dusters, and the rich, pungent smell of the leather itself. Julian and I had always spent Christmas together, so I envisaged our happy stay in a new country where we would go to school until the war was over. But shortly before the sailing date, my mother and father sat down with me in our rather formal lounge with unexpected news. the two families had decided that my cousin and I would not be going to Canada. We were to stay at home, after all. I knew they were tremendously happy. Everything seemed all right, and I would not be separated from my baby sister, Pamela. I do remember asking, "But the shoe-cleaning case?" They reassured me it was mine to keep. I recall no sense of upheaval and no great curiosity about the stalled adventure. Only as an adult did I hear, I believe from Julian, the full circumstances. The German government had learned of the children's boats, which had been sailing at 3 weekly intervals from Britain to Canada for several months. The boat immediately prior to the one on which my cousin and I were to sail was torpedoed, and all the children were lost. Britain cancelled the program. This time it was my parents, not I, who knew that there was nearly no Josie. Josephine Zell for Mind's Eye Radio.
My back was against the closed, locked door of the darkened store on the corner. My heart was pounding as I sank into my oversized gray jacket. In the fullness of my right sleeve was my metal baton, with one rubber-covered end in my right palm, ready to swing if I needed to. It was 10:30 p.m., and the streets were deserted. I was waiting for the bus that ran on Tui and Rogers after youth group at the synagogue. "A girl was raped just a few days ago," two boys mockingly chanted in my face as I got ready to go home. No one lived near me. Everyone knew I went home alone. Standing on the corner, sweat was dripping into my blouse. Suddenly, I saw the bus round the corner. The bus was empty, except for the driver and one man sitting near the back of the bus. I got off at Damon, where a bunch of boys hung out in front of the closed drugstore. Whitey was the only one I knew. I said hello, hoping, because I knew him, the other boys would let me pass without any trouble. Two more blocks to home. I looked into the outer hall, entered and took my key out and unlocked the inner hall door. Our basement apartment door was a few steps away. I opened our apartment door. I was home. Interior. The hidden place, under the stairs in a Dutch house, a room you cannot see from the outside, like a woman's life shared only with her journal. space carved by a resistance architect, into the back of the bedroom closet, where Corrie ten Boom hid six people at a time. Not even the Gestapo could find them on Harlem's Main Street above the watchmaker's shop. 3 days, the Gestapo posted guards. The first two were Dutch Nazi sympathizers. Corrie, in the interior of Vught, got the message. All your birds flew away. This is Judith Zuckerman for Mind's Eye Radio. For listeners who are curious to know more, Vught was a Dutch concentration camp run by the SS. You can still visit this hiding place in the more than 750-year-old interesting city of Haarlem, Netherlands, or read the book The Hiding Place by resistance fighter Corrie ten Boom, or see the film by the same name.
And this story by Greg Williard, Escape. My father, 82, filing his nails and talking about World War II. Most of the prisoners were boys or old men. They were scared, dirty animals. But this one prisoner, Hans was his name, he was a killer. SS, a real mean one. He'd beat up on the other prisoners. Old men and boys, his own men he'd beat up. When we told him to cut it out, he'd shuffle up to the fence and he'd say, "No English," with his fake little Nazi smile. My father showed a fake little Nazi smile. We had some MPs that were just as rough as Hans, though. Some nights, we'd hear rifle fire. Pop, pop, pop. Next morning, we'd be missing a couple of prisoners. The MPs always said they tried to escape, but we knew they hadn't. That's what happened to Hans. "You mean," I said, "they just shot him?" My father's smile grew warm. "That's right. He tried to escape." Animal, 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 animal Madison poet Lisa Marie Brodsky.
The Heel. I don't know if she's ever been to New York, the kind of New York that exists in a sort of picante mist where sassy hip ladies who smack cinnamon gum walk the streets. But my mother has worn heels. She's driven a fast car with a fast boy while the mint evergreen tree sways in the mirror. I know she's propped her leg out the window, and that just as they passed 45th, her red raised heel went sailing, curved sole, tight skirt. She could have belonged to New York. Egg rolls, newspapers flouncing down the street with paranoid pigeons, the red stiletto landing at the foot of a bench in Central Park. If you have a prisoner, let her go. Driving to her first job out of college, she releases the clutch and goes. Now that she's out of hospitals, the autumn chill does not reach her. Her scars are hidden rice paddies. It's her first apartment, and it's okay that she has no furniture. All she shows now glistens like starfish. Driving home from work, she releases her past life and goes. She goes and goes. Without stripes, she goes. In the poem Riddles and Bees, a child learns to overcome her parents' shadow. Riddles and Bees. The day I was told they were mine, the beehive exploded. A woman in a pastel gown floated down to me and said, "Be patient with them." Did she mean the bees or my parents? I wouldn't let love get in the way, like a cherubian baby shoved in my face, but I found forgiving them out of love made the sea stand still, the noise of the clicking clams pause in mid-click, and the nausea from all that rocking rest against the sandbar. Now the bees no longer remind me of her arms swarming around my own, and the dark, dry riddle he's always been forms letters behind my eyelids that spell out dump truck, elm tree, impossible dream. The poem The Offering is an otherworldly tale of despair escaping out the sixth-floor window. The Offering. I've finally shrunken myself. On a sliver moon night, I throw tired, withered balloons from my sixth-floor window. They make soft singing sounds as they sink, deflated, to the ground. The birds are quiet and waiting. You think that's music I make up in the choir loft? That's asking to be saved from myself. I am poison. A dog drools on the wooden floor waiting to gnaw on the leftovers. I lay on his tongue like bacteria, like a giddy child in a hiding place. An old woman in a peacock dress bends down and looks the dog in the eyes, notices how small the pupils are, how distant the life seems. She sees a girl falling from a sixth-floor window, falling like air, if air ever falls at all. This is Lisa Marie Brodsky for Mind's Eye Radio.
And what a time it was, it was a time of innocence, a time of confidences. Long ago it must be, I have a photograph. Preserve your memories, they're all that's left you.
Somewhere in there, along with Monica Lewinsky and Waco, poor Janet Reno, Clinton's attorney general, became embroiled with Cuba. Castro got into the act, and it all ended with a news segment of armed officers charging into a house and taking a small boy into custody so he could be returned to the land of his birth. The facts are as stated in the poem. His mother died. Elian was rescued, holding onto an inner tube after a boat sank. He became a bone in a big dogfight between Castro and the Cuban Miami contingent, who were determined to keep him in the U.S. It was all a big dog's breakfast. Everyone had an opinion, without knowing a damn thing about the facts. So what else is new? Asks poet Fran Rawl.
Hey, Elian. K-Tall. How's it going? I'm glad you have a dog to talk to. But since he has no real force in this matter, you need an advocate, a counselor, someone to observe and ask and decide this thing quickly. You are still swimming, Elian, in an ocean of half-truths, uncertainty, and partisanship. And heresy for even mentioning it. Does your father really, really want you to come back? Or has he got caught up by the whole nationalist thing? Would he dare say, hey, kid, I can't come, but I'll see you very soon, probably. This insanity can't last forever right off the coast of Florida. Then you can visit freely with us all. An advocate would try to find out how old Elian was when his father left, or was he forced out by another man? How much time were father and son really spending together? How does your stepmother feel about having a second child she didn't expect living with her? A young boy can be very active. Can she say what she wants? Can the father really? Elian, I find it fascinating that all these people who voted with their feet and those who didn't have to. Elian, I found it fascinating that all these people who voted with their feet and those who didn't have to think you should be returned to the land of your birth like a message in a bottle. What's the tip-off here? America is more than fancy toys, and Cuba is more than stepping off the edge of the earth. The only one I hear about who has seen some of both sides is the nun who supervised the visit with the grandmothers from Cuba. And she evidently was not satisfied with the whole visit. Why not? I don't know, and neither do all the writers of wisdom to the papers. Keep swimming, Elian. Grieve for your mother. Hold on to your inner tube. I think you need someone in there with you. This is Fran Rawl for Mind's Eye Radio, sinking into a sea of uncertainty, along with everybody else.
Thank you.
Escape can be more than just a temporary getaway from your life. It can be a permanent change. And sometimes, the best way to make a change is to seem to simply disappear, as the woman does in Lynn Patrick Smith's poem, The Vanishing Wife.
She wants to make a fresh start, putting behind her marriage to the mystery writer that held no suspense, even with his attempt at a disappearing act when she tracked him down at the Thirsty Cat, working on his latest book, The No-Account Girlfriend, mixing his murderous metaphors with a little too much gin. It was then she knew she must slip into a new identity, leave no traceable clues. So she stands in her sparse apartment, waiting for her past to dissipate and then disappear in the thin, gin-scented air. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Matt Felgus thought he peaked as a poet at 17, but wrote this piece in 1988 at the age of 23. As we all sometimes do, he felt trapped. This poem, although he did not realize it then, puts voice to the need to follow his life path, despite a strong urge to escape.
Fly on a stained glass window. I know I can't get out of here, but I buzz and crash into the solid glass regardless. See, even though I can't get out, I see light. And although I should look elsewhere, I'm afraid I'll lose my light.
Matt tries another means of escape, this time in his human form, using one of his favorite means.
The drive. He flew through the intersection. Green light. It was dark. Enjoying the sensation of speed. Of escape. Radio blasting. Tires squealing to grip the narrow curves. Slowly at first. The realization. He was crossing the same intersection. Over and over. The same green light. A scene on pause. Yet he was moving. Without warning. The light flashed red. He slammed the brakes. Spun into the middle of the intersection. Headlights approaching fast from all directions, it seemed, and he was unable to move. Closed his eyes and waited for a crash that never came. When he finally looked, minutes later, there were no lights, no intersection on this dark curving road. He was free. Flying away, this is Matt Felgus for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thank you.
Writer John Morgan reminds us that we can often escape bad luck by using our head. But here, he gives us a précis of how he escaped bad luck, in spite of using his head. Or, ouch!
When I was a boy, I would sometimes hear the pronouncement, "Someone ought to knock some sense into that kid." They weren't talking about me. Nevertheless, I thought I could use more sense than I had, and vaguely wondered if maybe I could get some knocked into me. The first chance I had to find out came when some kid in school threw an apple at my head at the approximate speed of light. I didn't know that an apple could feel like a rock. If I had found out which kid did that, I would have knocked some sense into him for sure. My head was sore for a day, but I escaped serious injury. My next chance came soon enough. When my mother took up painting, my father decided to build her a studio out by the woods behind our house. He enlisted my help and taught me the basics of carpentry. I learned not to stand by a precariously perched 2x4. My head bled some, so I thought surely it must have knocked some sense into me. After a week, I gave up hope and resigned myself to my disillusionment, but I escaped serious injury. My third chance was when I jumped out the school bus door and cracked my head on the top of the door frame. This rash action was caused by my euphoric mood after listening to two girls, Stick and Brick, singing on the back of the bus. They knew all the hit songs and sang them with angelic voices. I was always sad to see them get off the bus, Stick by the lumberyard and Brick by the brickyard. I came home dripping blood. Though this failed to knock any sense into me, once again I escaped serious injury. It was another few years before I had a chance to have some sense knocked into me. Crossing a parking lot one day, I took a running start and jumped across a frozen puddle, landing right smack on another frozen puddle. When I heard the crack of the back of my head on the pavement, I was sure I had a fractured skull or a concussion. But when I got up, there was no pain, no blood, no bump, nothing. I still had no sense, but at least I escaped serious injury. My last opportunity came when the bookshelf I had just built fell over on me when I was sleeping. I woke up buried alive in books. As I arose from the rubble, I looked at the book I was clutching in my right hand. It was one I had been meaning to read for a few years. I took this as a sign from fate. She was saying to me, "Here's this book, now read it, damn it." So I read it, which is one of the most sensible things I ever did. It was Mary McCarthy's book, The Group, which I consider one of the great American novels. Life had finally succeeded in knocking some sense into me, but it wasn't easy. Life had to play rough with me to wise me up, but at least I escaped serious injury. This is John Morgan, now reasonably sensible, for Mind's Eye Radio.
Music and art provide escape from the troubles of everyday life, but if it's good music or good art, this escape is an escape into a deeper sense of life, a reconciliation that brings us back to ourselves as if we're returning home. In Woman with Flute, Mind's Eye poet and songwriter Paul Thompson portrays a woman who finds just such an escape beside the sunset sea.
sways the fire that ends the day and brings the memories of night. She plays the sweet hot taste of love, the stolen hours of dark delight. The pain of helpless loss. She plays the times of bitter tears. She plays the slow burn of regret, the even slower turn of years.
Oh, this is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to The Great Escape, or There Must Be Some Way Out of Here, by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. Our show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Today's contributors are Fran Rawl, Esther Cameron, Lisa Marie Brodsky, Paul Thompson, John Morgan, Judy Zuckerman, Josie Zell, Bridget Birdsall, Guy Thorvaldsen, Lynn Patrick Smith, Matt Felgus, and Greg Williard. Our music is by Barbara Chusett. For more information about our show, you can turn to www.mindseyeaudio.com, or you can listen online at radio4all.net, and that's the number 4. Wishing you happy escapes in the future, this is Greg Williard with Mind's Eye Radio.